Subway everyday value means many mouth-watering piled high favorites are $5 footlongs, like the fresh-toasted tempting meatball marinara. And made-to-your-order BLT, the $5 footlong anthem rolls on only at Subway, where great everyday value lives. Subway, eat fresh. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, beautiful Wednesday here in Southern California. Active morning for me so far on my Twitter page, which can be reached at sportsguy33, all lowercase. So, twitter.com/sportsguy33. I've thrown my hat into the ring for the Minnesota Timberwolves job. The GM job, which apparently they cannot find candidates for. Joe Mead.
Yes.
They can't find a GM.
You know, I'm available as well.
I just wrote a 700-page NBA book explaining all the secrets of how to win an NBA team and everything that's ever happened in NBA history. I think I have a pretty firm grasp on how to win.
Yeah, you know, I think your publisher should go ahead and forward them a few copies.
Yeah, I don't need a resume. How about my 700-page book? There's my resume. Here's the thing. Wait, if you're the Timberwolves, where are you going? How are you relevant? What can you possibly do? You're in a small market. You have a bunch of good players, but you don't have a guy like LeBron. A bunch of good young players, I should say. You have a lot of cap space in a couple of years. Other than that, you are nationally irrelevant, and locally, the Vikings are always going to supersede whatever you do. So what do you do? How do you get more fans? How do you get more people involved? You know what you do? You hire a sports columnist. It's controversial. That would lead PTI. In my opinion, any move that doesn't actually damage your franchise that would potentially lead PTI and be mentioned on a late night talk show and all that stuff, these are all good things. Sports Illustrated writing a feature about it. Can he do it? Does Simmons have the credentials? Again, people talking about the team. This is a team that finished 27th in attendance last year. This is a team that has not made the playoffs in 4 years. This is a team that is always suspected as being one of the teams that might go bankrupt. Why not me? Why not? Seriously, could I do worse than half of these guys? Would I have ever traded for Zach Randolph? Would I have ever given away Steve Francis' expiring contract to get... Oh, no. What did Isaiah do? Joe Mead, what did Isaiah do? He took Steve Francis' expiring contract.
He sure did.
He gave away Penny Hardaway's expiring contract. That's what it is. I never would have done that. I would never overpay for bad guys. I would never give Corey Maggette $50 million. I would try to find three guys to build my team around, a la the Spurs, a la the Celtics, a la the Lakers. Three guys, that's my foundation. Surround them with role players who give a crap about winning. And that's what I'm doing. There's a blueprint for how to do this, and none of these GMs, they all like panic and they do dumb things. I would not panic, and here's why. Because I have a fallback job. I'm a writer. I'm a podcast host. I'm an author. I occasionally appear on TV doing bad segments. I have things going on. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. I'm going to take chances. I'm the guy you want. I'm the guy who's going to not be worried that I have to do this because I might get fired, or I need to make this team a 38-win team instead of a 28-win team, and maybe I'll be able to keep a job another year. I'm not going to care. I'm going to try to build a team. I'm going to try to build you a champion. I'm going to try to make the Minnesota Timberwolves matter again. And if I can't do it for them, then maybe I can do it for the LA Clippers. Although, from all the experiences I've had with them, they are honestly probably too dumb to even consider hiring me. And what's funny is that they could bring back Mike Dunleavy this year, and from what people with the team have told me, it will cost them literally, potentially, between $8 and $10 million of people who are bailing on the team and have just had it and just cannot believe that this guy is being brought back. That's a bad move. When you say that your coach has 2 years, $11 million left on his contract, and you don't want to eat that money, so you bring him back, but then you lose $10 million worth of season ticket money. Joe Mead.
Yes.
That's dumb.
Sounds
dumb
to me.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do it.
Mike Dunleavy has sunk cost. The Clipper fans have given up on him. They have no hope with the team as long as he's there. The players have given up on him. In fact, they've quit. They quit 3 years ago. This is the stuff I don't understand. I mean, you know, I know the world is screwed up, and I know our economy is screwed up, and there are plenty of corporations who do the wrong thing and make the wrong choices and don't see into the future and all that stuff. So obviously the NBA is going to be like that. You're going to have 30 teams. You're going to have teams that make mistakes. You're going to have teams that don't do the right thing. I get that. What I don't understand is this is simple math. This is you owe this guy $11 million for 2 years. The entire fan base dislikes him and wants him to go. And people now are bailing on season tickets because he is coming back. The math adds up. You lose maybe $10 million if you bring him back, or you lose $11 million if you fire him, and maybe, you know, $3, $4 million on a new coach. This drives me crazy. Matt, I started without you. I was just ranting and raving.
Sorry about that. I was doing an interview that ran really, really long, so sorry about that.
We have Matt Taibbi of – that's how you pronounce it, right?
Right, right.
Because your dad was Mike Taibbi.
That's right. That's right.
And is. Actually, I should say is, right?
He still is.
Still is.
Yeah.
And growing up, when I was going to high school in the Connecticut area, I was very familiar with Mr. Taibbi's work.
Where did you go to high school?
I went to high school in Greenwich, Connecticut at a place called Brunswick Academy. Uh-huh. Which was an all-boys school, and our sister school was Greenwich Academy. A great way to just get demolished emotionally and romantically when your sister school is Greenwich Academy. I wanted to have you on for a variety of reasons, one of which is that you're smarter than me.
Yeah, right.
I think we're equal with sports. We're equal with sports, but then you know stuff about politics and the economy that I just kind of glean from other people. I don't know how you do it. How do you follow sports and politics and the economy and the world? Like, how do you have 24 hours in a day to follow all this stuff?
Well, I'd be following sports no matter what, because that's what I actually care about.
Right.
The other stuff is what I do for a living. So I think in the same way most people follow sports and they have a job, it's kind of the same thing with me. You know.
But you're not married.
Not yet, no, actually.
See, that's how you can follow all this stuff, because you're not married. When you get married, you have to pick and choose. You have to say, I either have Saturday for college football or Sunday for the NFL, but I can't have both.
Have you had to do that?
Yeah, I made that. I gave up college football about 6 years ago.
That's not a terrible loss.
I'm not missing much. I'm missing a sport that has no playoff system.
That's true. That's exciting. Definitely exciting.
But like for last year, for instance, say you're a sports fan, but then, you know, really the most amazing political election we've had since 1960. And
yeah,
that's going
it was,
on.
It was a very, very interesting year to be on the campaign trail for sure. But, you know, I think what a lot of political reporters I know right now are really bummed out because, you know, during campaign season, it's all easy. Everybody knows what the issues are. You know, McCain is screaming about one thing, Obama is screaming about something else. It's all out in the open. Mm. And then when the financial crisis happens, nobody understands any of this stuff. And we're all kind of wishing it was election season again because it's just such a nightmare. So that's probably another reason why I'm following sports more these days, because I just don't even understand the stuff that I'm writing about.
On the other hand, the economy and what's happened to it was a nice way to keep, you know, the discourse going. Because for a year, actually 2 years, everybody was, who's going to win the election? What are the issues? Who should we vote for?
Right.
Who's better? And then that ended, and we were left with this president that basically you couldn't, there was no real discourse about him. It's like, yeah, this is either going to work or it's not. Everybody liked him. Everybody was going to give the benefit of the doubt. And
and
he was also this guy that had positioned himself in a way that where we knew him, but we didn't know him. Kind of like LeBron James. but then the economy happens and boom, now we have all this stuff to talk about. And, you know, it trickled into the end of the election and now it's just going and going and going. And, you know, what's been interesting to me is like Bill Maher, which I watch every week, mm-hmm. He has seamlessly made the transition from talking about politics to now talking about the economy and trying to learn stuff and have guests that know stuff. And it's actually been interesting.
Yeah, it's funny. I know a couple of prominent television hosts who I'm probably not going to name here, but I was invited on to talk about the economy. And in the breaks, this one person said to me, I don't understand any of this stuff, and I have to go on the air every night and talk about it. So it's a pretty hard transition for a lot of these people because, you know, none of us ever heard of stuff like credit default swaps or,
yeah,
you know, the collateralized debt obligation or the synthetic, unfunded, uncollateralized CDO or whatever that stuff is. And we just don't know what that stuff is, but we have to in order to talk about it, you know?
Right.
And as you know, in the media, you can't stop talking. That's not an option.
Well, and then the other thing is now in the age of accountability, it's not like 1995 where you could just be like, ah, I'll just write about it. I'll read a couple of things and I'll just have a dumb opinion on it and nobody will ever call me out on it. Now it's like, man, if you get... I'm sure you get this because they run your stuff online. You get one fact wrong, you screw up one point, you are going to get murdered by whoever is on the opposite side of what you're arguing, and it has to be perfect.
Oh, yeah. Now if you make a mistake in print, it's like herpes. It stays with you forever, you know? I mean, and then sometimes it flares up, and then sometimes it goes away, but, you know, it never, ever leaves the Internet, and it's a terrible thing. That's why, you know, a lot of people are really gun shy to write about the economy at all because they're afraid to say something stupid, which has happened to a bunch of us actually in the last 6 months or so.
Well, you've been on, you know, one of the dangers with being opinionated, whether you're a writer, a radio host, TV host, whatever, and having really strong opinions and having conviction in them, is that there can be backlash from time to time. And you suffered that backlash in 2005 with a column you wrote about the Pope.
Yeah.
And you felt that about as much as anyone's going to feel it, right?
Yeah, that was really funny. I had a column in the New York Press, and I wrote this, I was late for a flight, so I had to finish a column really fast. So I just tossed off this thing that was, the 52 funniest things about the upcoming death of the Pope. This is before the Pope died.
Right.
And, you know, it wasn't really funny at all. It was just a whole bunch of really mean things about the Pope dying, and I sent it off. And I went off. I had to go cover the Michael Jackson trial, and my editor, in my absence, decided to put it on the cover.
Oh boy!
And the next thing I know, I turn on the TV in California, and I'm seeing that Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer and Bloomberg and all these people are on TV denouncing me. You know?
Wow!
I had never experienced anything like that before.
Did you apologize? You did, right? Or kind of, sort of?
No, I didn't really apologize. No, the newspaper apologized, sort of, for us, but we all ended up getting fired after that. So.
Really?
Yeah, that sort of indirectly led to the ouster of pretty much the entire editorial staff. I mean, we all left within a series of months after that. So.
Yeah, after Janet Jackson was the tipping point. And after that, it's like everybody's just crazy, crazy uptight. And it's getting worse. And I've noticed it ever since
ESPN. You must get it like crazy. I mean, you know, sports people are actually, from what I noticed, like, for instance, I wrote this thing about Cashman a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
I got more mail about that and, like, more angry, psychotic mail about that than I get about most political things. And so you must get that all the time, I would imagine. Right?
Yeah, well, what you find out is, you know, you're going to have if you're going to write and you're going to have opinions, obviously those opinions aren't going to be popular with everybody. It's impossible.
Right.
So if I'm making fun of Kobe and I'm correctly pointing out that this guy has managed his public persona as, you know, really as well and as smart and as manipulative as anybody we've seen this decade, the Laker fans, well, actually, I shouldn't say the all Laker fans, because there's two type of Laker fans. There's the Kobe fan who is just blindly going to defend him and cry conspiracy with anything involving him. And then there's the Laker fan who kind of knows, yeah, we kind of need him. I kind of deep down know what he's
kind of,
probably
kind of
like.
A damn Yankees thing. It's a deal with the devil. Kind
yeah,
of.
A little bit. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say it's that bad, but yeah, in that same vein. But,
right.
But yeah, anytime I write about Kobe, you get the emails, I get great emails, which I always forward to my editor. Like, can we use this at mailbag? It'd be like 15 F-bombs, four slurs about my sexuality. And it's like, this would be just awesome to run a mailbag of just all these crazy. But yeah, it's, you know, I think with the internet, you definitely see it where people, they fire off an email and they feel better.
Yeah,
and that's
they've got courage that they wouldn't have in real life. You know, another thing that's really interesting about it for me is having, you know, covering both sports and politics, is that you see the similarities between the outrage you get from an angry fan and from, you know, an angry Republican or an angry, you know, Democrat. The instinct we have in politics these days is almost exactly the same as sports. You have people who root for the red team, and you have people who root for the blue team, and they're divided you know, the way they view the issues is almost exactly the same. I mean, if you're a Patriots fan, you don't think Belichick was a cheater. If you're a Jets fan, you do think he was a cheater. And that's exactly the way, you know, people look at, you know, when I interview people on the campaign trail, it's, you know, did Bush misuse intelligence? Well, of course he did if you're at a Democratic rally. And if, you know, did he, of course he didn't if you're at, you know, a McCain rally. And that's just, it's weird that it's exactly the same, phenomenon at play, it seems to me.
So funny you mentioned this, because that was actually the basis of an idea I submitted for a column to my magazine. Mm-hmm. Back in before the primaries had gone through. And this was when we, you know, they really wanted us to just stay away completely from the election. They said I couldn't write it. But the thesis was going to be just what you said, except I think there's one difference.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a Yankee fan and, you know, the team sucks, Cashman sucks, Marion Rivera's in the tank, Jabba's not doing well, Teixeira's not hitting, and so on and so on, at some point you're just going to admit it. Yeah. This has been disappointing. My team sucks. You're not going to just blindly follow them into the gates of hell.
Right.
With politics, the one difference is that no matter how things are going, how bad things are going, how terrible things are going, they will still defend.
Oh yeah.
You defend your party, and that's just what you do.
That's absolutely true, because you know the. You can't flip anything by fans. I mean, if Joe Girardi, leaves in Damaso Marte to face Youkilis in the ninth inning, and people think that's whatever inning that was in the extra innings, and people think that's a mistake, you're going to get 10,000 letters about it the next day. But if Chuck Schumer signs off on a bill that gives $50 billion to some company that donated $100,000 to his campaign, well, I mean, he's probably not going to hear from one person about that. Maybe two.
Yeah.
We just demand an awful lot more from our sports executives than we do from our elected officials, which is pretty embarrassing.
Yeah, but that's weird though, because if the Yankees are your team, they're your team. You can admit when things are going well and when there's not. But if you're a Republican, the Republicans are your team. That doesn't mean you just have to totally blindly support them. Same for the Democrats. If something goes wrong, something goes wrong. Like, if you don't admit that, it kind of, you lose credibility with your argument, don't you?
But I think what happens is that people don't just look at the behavior of the party that they support. They look at everything in terms of, is this going to help the other guy?
You right. know?
And what's true, I think, is that in politics, people hate the other side a lot more than they like their own side. And so even if their own party does something that's, maybe not so good or immoral or corrupt, what they want to see more, what they're more afraid of is not the actual corruption. It's whether or not that's going to be a benefit to the Democrats or whoever, they don't support. And I think that's why people don't get so upset about a lot of the things that their own parties do. I mean, you'll note it like this recent, Tea Party phenomenon with these the tea bag thing. Mm. All these people who are furious about spending all of a sudden, well, they're the same people who didn't say a word when there was a $4 trillion debt racked up during the Bush years, because, if they had made any noise about it back then, it would have helped the Democrats.
The greatest example of all time is the Writers Guild. The Writers Guild, who everybody out here was so, pro-Democrat and so anti-Bush, just killing him. How can people? And then, their union walks them into one of the most idiotic strikes that's ever happened.
Mm-hmm.
Where they're basically giving up 7 months of paychecks to get these digital residuals that they don't even know what they are. And the companies are telling them, dude, we don't know how to monetize this yet. We're not lying to you. Like, literally, we have no idea. We have no idea where this is going. And this guy is in charge of the union, Patrick Verrone, who is like, this mediocre writer. Like, the best thing he's ever going to do in life is lead this union. And he's, turns into Norma Rae and gets all these people to give up 7-8 months of paychecks, gives the TV networks a chance to say, wow, maybe we don't have to give out 125 development deals every spring. Maybe we could just give out 25. And now, coupled with the economy, this has led to this it's just a disaster, basically, in Hollywood with writers. And if you're a writer, you're, you know, it's four times more difficult to get a job than it was 3 years ago. And yet this guy is still trumping, like, yeah, the strike, well, this was great and this worked. And but what made me crazy, and, you know, I've talked to this, only like a few people can even see this, but what made me crazy is that they followed this guy just as blindly as everybody followed Bush in 2001, 2002, 2003. And then when everybody turned, how could you follow Bush like that? How could you just, whatever, you know, just jump behind every decision he makes? They did the same thing with the union president.
Right. They walked into the same buzzsaw, right?
You hypocrites. And you're still defending him. Like, it just drives me crazy. Like, at least admit that the strike was a bad idea. You give up 7 months of paychecks for not much. But, that's what I don't get is like, you know, and that's one of the reasons I love sports is because it's so black and white and we could keep score. There are wins and losses. If Brian Cashman's doing a bad job with a $260 million payroll, we'll see the results of the field.
Right.
Let's talk about your column you wrote about him. Which I was very jealous of as I emailed you. This is the first time we'd exchanged emails. And I was like, damn it. Like, this guy wrote this angle that I would have loved to have written. I'm so mad I didn't think of it. But you make a great point. Like, this guy, is there an easier job than being the Yankees GM?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I think what I said in the piece is it's like asking Sarah Jessica Parker to buy dresses all day long. Right.
Right.
I mean, it's almost impossible to screw up. And the system is really, the baseball system is really set up to make it failure proof for a team with pockets that are as deep as the Yankees, and they found, almost as if they were trying really hard through diligent scientific research, they found the one way to screw it all up. And by packing their roster with over 30 needy, paranoid, you know, multimillionaire celebrity, you know, talent. And they completely forsaken every, you know, the 25 to 30 year old players that you need to have on the roster in order to win. And they just fell into that one loophole. It's amazing. And it's really, as a Red Sox fan, it's pretty satisfying to listen to Mike Francesa today. And
I heard about it. I was getting emails about that today. He went off the deep end, right?
he looked like Mussolini in his broadcast this morning. He was just going nuts. It was hilarious.
This is unacceptable. We cannot accept what is happening here.
Can't happen.
Five Red Sox wins. No Yankee wins. Can't happen. This can't happen. Not acceptable. These are the days when you just, you know, I miss Mike and the Mad Dog all the time, but a day today would have been just where, holy mackerel, dog just gleefully cackling and Mike having an aneurysm. I mean,
this is an example, exactly an example of what we were just talking about before. I enjoy watching the Yankees and the Yankee fans suffer more than I enjoy reading, you know, about the Red Sox and sort of basking in their victories. Like, these are the days that are the sweetest for me, is waking up in the morning and going out and getting the Post and the Daily News and waiting for my Francesa to come on. It's really...
Well, it's interesting that these two teams have taken such different paths because, you know, I'm not going to say the Red Sox have been perfect because they've certainly spent money in the wrong guys and they've made a couple of the wrong decisions and so on and so on. But the heart of what they've tried to do has stayed pretty pure. And that is to, you want to get guys who are coming into that 28 to 32 range, not guys who are about to leave that range.
Right.
You want to spend your money on, if you're going to spend the money, you want to spend the money on guys who haven't peaked yet, basically. And then you're going to spend the rest of the money in your farm system. And instead of spending $160 million on Sabathia, you're going to spend $5 million on the guy who dropped to the first bottom of the first round because he's represented by Scott Boras. In the ninth round, the guy who wants to play college quarterback at Nebraska. But you say, hey, buddy, hey, here's $6 million. You know, and that's the kind of stuff they've been doing. They spend more money on scouts. They've flooded Latin America and Japan and all these different markets, and it's starting to pay off.
Right.
Whereas you have the Yankees who have not really grown anybody.
That's what's so amazing about it is the way the amateur draft is set up. You know, a team with a lot of money can basically buy itself extra draft picks just by hauling in every overslot talent that, you know, that falls in the draft because of the signability concerns. I mean, that's why the Red Sox have Lars Anderson and all these guys because they identified these people who are going to cost too much and they go grab those guys in the amateur draft and you know, it ends up, you know, just as you said, instead of spending $160 million on Sabathia, they spend $11 million in their amateur draft, and that's the way you use your financial resources to your advantage. Now, I'm not saying that that's, you know, that's not any less evil, you know, using your financial advantage than the Yankees are. It's just that it's just not smart what the Yankees are doing. You know,
it's a little evil. I mean, I think all Red Sox fans, and I've even written this, Red Sox fans are in a little bit of denial over the fact that we have kind
of
turned into the Yankees. Let's be honest. Like Red Sox, Yankees, Mets, it's just a different economic playing field than everybody else. And now with what happened with Madoff and everything, I think the Mets have dropped out of that class. But
yeah,
the Red Sox have the capacity to say, you know what, Detroit? We'll trade for Miggy Cabrera, and we will give you three prospects for him, and we'll take Dontrelle Willis's contract. Just give it to us. We'll take that off your hands.
Right.
And we'll also give you whatever, and it would economically be ridiculous for you not to do this. They have the capacity to do that, whereas maybe the Yankees, and that's about it. I can't think of one other team.
Right. Right. Which is gonna happen too, by the way, because the fork in David Ortiz's back is getting longer by the minute. Right?
Yeah, it's not good. It's actually it hurts my soul.
Yeah,
it's tough. I was watching him yesterday. He had such a bad swing. It was like the seventh inning yesterday. It's raining out. They brought some lefty in. Not even a good lefty. Somebody he would have creamed back in the day. And his swings were just so feeble. Yeah, it was really upsetting.
Ever had like an old dog in the house that's like close to death? And it used to be a really chipper dog that used to come and play with you all the time. But then as it gets towards the end, it just kind of spends all its time by itself and hangs out in the corner.
And it looks frail.
That's what he looks like right now. It's really sad.
Yeah, it's not good. And we saw it happen with Jim Rice 20 years ago. And when it's happening, you know. And, I mean, I'm not ruling out him potentially coming back. But, you know, the difference is this isn't a slump. This is a guy who can no longer catch up to a 92-mile-an-hour fastball and who has lost his power.
Right.
And, you know, I think you just look at his body and you look at the history of these sluggers who are built like brick asses. And these guys, their knees are the first thing that goes. And that's always the thing I always watch with Poppy was when he was like really locked in, he'd be in that crouch. I always compared it to like some sort of like cobra ready to strike. He had the knees bent a little bit, almost like a golf swing.
Right.
And he'd spring up from out of the knees. And the power really came from not just his arms, but his knees. His knees were what was propelling him. And now his knees are just gone and you can see it. And, you know, I don't know if he needs surgery or what the deal is, but he's just not the same. He looks like he's got the Lieutenant Dan legs, basically, you know? My question is, when do they move him down in the order?
I don't know. I mean, what are they going to do? What can they do? I mean, I guess they can move him down in the order, but pretty soon it's going to become an even bigger issue than that. They're going to have to either come up with a phony injury or I don't know what they're going to do. And then what's the option from them? I guess they're going to steal one of Detroit's players probably. But
well, the if there is good news, it is the last year of his contract.
Right. Next year is the last year of his contract.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure that he's signed through next year. I read that in the Globe this morning.
Hold on. I got to pop 4 Xanax. I'll be right back. I'm so depressed. Really? Next year this is going to? Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure.
Oh, my God, no.
Sure. Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Oh, yeah. This isn't good. Well, at least Mike Lowell has shown, like, a little rejuvenation.
Yeah.
That's been good.
Yeah.
As you said, though, the bottom line is they could just go out and get somebody else. Thanks, Poppy. Like, look at what happened with Julio Lugo. Like, this guy, he's got this year and next year left for $20 million, and there's a chance that he might get bumped from his starting job by somebody who I'd never heard of until 6 weeks ago, Nick Green. It's like, Nick Green, is that stage game?
Like the 15-game winning streak with Nick Green as the starting shortstop.
Yeah, just goes to show you. You know, you're talking about with teams spending their resources in the right way. I think we've seen that happen with the Portland Trailblazers as well in the NBA, where the old way of thinking in all sports was that we have a lot of money. I will overbid for this guy and you can't get him. You know, hey, Brian Grant, you know, and now it's a little different. Now it's like, we have a lot of money and Phoenix's owner is broke. Here's $3 million for your number one. And that's, you know, now all of a sudden, and you know, Portland's, prowess as this team of the future, I think, has been really, really overrated. But at the same time, they have a lot of small pieces, you know?
Right.
And I think that's where sports is going to some degree, using your resources not to blow everyone away, but actually with a long-term vent.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, what they're going to, you know, the next time somebody like, you know, a Garnett becomes available, they're going to have the pieces to go out and get him. You know, now you have to have the Rafe LaFrance contract on your books.
Mm.
Did he expire, by the way? Is that
he expired. Now,
who's the next Rafe LaFrance?
Well, there's been a lot of thought about this. You got Larry Hughes.
Okay.
Potentially, he's in the mix. I think he's the odds-on favorite right now. It would also be fun to say Larry Hughes has expiring contract.
Right.
But there's
is he disqualified because he can still play though a little bit?
But that's that. Yeah, you're right. I mean, I'll really have to look at it. It'll probably be somebody who blows out his knee this summer. What's interesting is that there's a couple of smaller scale expiring contracts, like Brian Cardinal, Brian Scalabrine, basically all the white guys who got overpaid, which will never happen again.
Mm-hmm.
But even like somebody like Scalabrine, I think you'll hear a lot next year. I really don't know what's going to happen in the NBA because the attendance figures were just so much worse than they reported. You know, they just report the actual butts in the seats and not the fact that, you know, Detroit's entire upper deck was sitting there for $1.
Right.
So that, you know, and I wrote about it in February and it's much worse now. And the story really hasn't come out yet fully, but you know, you're talking about the Pacers. Can you just lose $40 million a year? Like, who wants to do that?
Right.
It's like, yeah,
how long is that going to go on?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah,
like,
I own a team.
Baseball's going through the same thing, isn't it? I mean,
pretty much. And, you know, the one thing that stood out, because I have the package, when you watch these games, and I'm watching all the AL games, a lot of empty seats, more than usual. I know it's a little colder, it's April, early May, but, man, you know, you just see empty seats behind the hitters all the time now. I don't ever remember seeing that before.
I was watching, you know, the end of a Padres game last night, and they flashed a scene in the crowd, and there was a couple sitting in the stands all by themselves. It looked like they had chosen that spot to have an intimate date alone, you know, late
right.
at night. And there was like literally nobody in the entire section except for them. And it seems like that's happening all over the league right now. So,
well, I noticed, what game was I watching last night? Oh, it was a Dodgers game. The Dodgers are red hot right now. They have not lost at home. Manny is on fire, which kills me, but that's a whole other story. And somebody hit a ball to right field. It either went over the wall or hit the wall. Oh, it went over the wall. And there was like three rows of fans in right field, and that's it. And, you know, for Dodger Stadium is a hidden gem. I don't know if you've been there, but it's a very cool stadium, especially at night games, because it's like very throwback 60s. You feel like you're in a Mad Men episode when you're there.
Mm-hmm.
Like you just want to like smoke Marlboro Reds and eat bad food. You can see the mountains. It's just great. But if you get those first few rows in the outfield seats, those are just awesome seats and they're cheap and, you know, it's just great. I've never seen that few people there for when the Dodgers were good. That made me wonder, like, where is this
going? There are empty seats now?
Like last night. Like this homer went into the right field stands and there were three rows of people there and that's it.
Wow.
So it was basically 50 people fighting for this home run ball. And it's, you know, this is still pretty early. This is early May on a really nice day in Los Angeles. So I don't know where.
Is that the Manny Woods section?
It might be. Oh, you wouldn't. Where do you live? You live in New York, right?
Yeah.
How do you do that?
How do I live in New York?
As a Red Sox fan, because I see the Yankee hats and the Yankee jersey. Like even I was there 2 weeks ago and some guy had like a Posada All-Star jersey on and a Yankee cap during one of the Yankee Sox games. I just wanted to fight him. It's bothered me.
Yeah, the people are weirdly intense about that. Yeah, I wore a Red yeah. Sox hat out a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I actually got stopped by a policeman. And he
really?
Turned out that he was joking, but he, you know, for the first 5 minutes of his rap, he was like, you know, you shouldn't be wearing that outside. What's going on with that? That kind of stuff. He was completely deadpan about it. But
well, how long have you lived there?
Since 2002, I guess.
Oh, so beautiful. So you've been there for the transformation of, in the old days, if they saw the Red Sox hat, you would just take copious amounts of
abuse.
Crap. Yeah. Hey, Red Sox. Hey, 1918. Gonna lose again? Hey, we own you.
Exactly. Exactly.
Not anymore. You don't hear that anymore.
Yeah, in fact, I used to live right around the corner from the hotel where the Sox used to stay, and I remember seeing Kevin Millar giving the fans the finger as he stepped off the bus to get into the hotel. It was pretty funny.
Have you been to the mausoleum yet?
The new one?
Yeah.
No, I have not. Have you?
Have not. Really looking forward to it. I wrote it yesterday. I'm just so delighted on so many levels that the Yankees decided to destroy their home field advantage. Like, just obliterate it. Take the best thing that they have going year after year, and they've killed it. It's gone.
Just because of the park, the aerodynamics, or what?
There's a bunch of things. It doesn't seem like it's as intimate. They totally priced out that lower section. So really anybody that's going to be there is on some sort of corporate date. All
right.
The real fans are stuck in the top tier.
Right. And then not only that, they prevent you from getting to the lower tier.
So you can't move down. And then the empty seats, like, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing.
Right.
There should not be a Yankee Stadium game that I'm watching where I see 50 empty seats behind Dustin Pedroia's head.
Right.
It's just wrong.
Right.
It's fundamentally wrong.
Yeah, that was another thing Francesa was having an aneurysm about this morning. It was pretty funny.
Yeah.
He was. Well, you ever see the movie Scanners?
Yeah.
he was looking like that just before the head explodes. It was pretty.
It's the go-to movie reference for anytime anyone's head explodes. It makes me think, it's been 30 years. Somebody should come up with a movie where, like, Katherine Heigl's head explodes. And they could be like, yeah, it's like that boyfriend movie with Katherine Heigl where her head explodes. What do you think about my credentials of being an NBA GM for either the Timberwolves?
I think it's long overdue. Have you gotten a call? I don't see why it shouldn't happen.
I threw my ring in the hat for the Timberwolves today. I'm willing to move to Minnesota. I'm willing to work for free for the first year as long as I can write a book about it. And my whole thing is this. When so many people are doing this job wrong, how can you say that there's a right way to go about finding a GM?
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's like if there's an 80% failure rate, then why do we have to be conventional? I don't know.
I have no idea. Plus, if you're actually willing to work for free, that starts you off at a pretty good advantage because, you know, a lot of what they starts $8 million in the hole if you're hiring somebody just to fail, like a Mike Dunleavy or somebody like that.
Right. Well, listen, if Jesse Ventura could be the governor of Minnesota, I could be the GM of the Minnesota Timberwolves.
Right.
Gosh darn it.
But, I mean, look, didn't Mike D just leave to, the Red Sox to go be a GM of a football team or something like that?
Yeah, what I think a lot of these teams have figured out is that you just want somebody who's smart. Like the Celtics have a president right now named Rich Gotham that, you know, was one of the guys who was in there on the ground floor for Lycos and cashed out, and he was smart. And they were like, yeah, he hasn't worked in sports, but this guy's smart. Let's get him.
Right.
And I think we've seen more and more sports teams starting to think like that.
Right.
We don't need to just hire somebody because he sat on the bench of the 86 Celtics for 2 years. You know, like, what about a guy who actually just made, you know, $10 million in 1999 because he was smart and saw some things coming ahead of time? Maybe this guy will help us.
Right.
And it seems like more and more teams have guys like that. I met a few of them when I went to the Sloan Sports Conference at MIT, which is, I call Dorkapalooza. But, you talk to some of these executives and they're just sharp dudes. They're not these yahoos that were like, yeah, I was a broadcaster for the team, and then I was assistant coach, and then I kind of fell into it, and I was out with the owner one night, and we had a few cocktails in him, and he said, yeah, you're the new GM. You know, it's these guys that have actually, they have MBAs, and they went to Harvard and Wharton.
Sure, because that's what a lot of people who, people who will go to Harvard and Wharton, they like sports too. They're still guys, so, you know, if they decide they want to do something that they really want to do, then sports is going to be one of the places that they go, you know?
You would think.
It seems
like people are figuring it out, just in general. Like, I feel like sports teams are starting to get smarter, and maybe it's because you got younger people moving in, and it's not like the old guard. But then on the other hand, then like Washington hires Flip Saunders, and it's like, wow, we have just...
Well, can't you get ESPN to lean on one of these teams and offer them some kind of inducement? Like we'll give you five primetime games next year. If
Ooh,
you guys,
interesting!
Right?
I didn't think about that. Yeah, maybe like we film a reality show and you get like $3 million.
Right.
I could be like the Hogans. Right. I hope it doesn't turn out that way.
Yeah, hey, I mean, I think, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to mention, you know, you write for Men's Journal and Rolling Stone. I just started getting Rolling Stone again like 6 months ago because my friend Camp is the director of circulation and apparently a bigwig, which is amazing to me. But it's a really good magazine. There's always two or three things in there that it takes me like a half hour to read. I always judge magazines by how long it takes me to read, which is why Us Weekly is the godfather of magazines for me.
We own that too, by the way.
Yeah, of course. It takes 40 minutes to read Us Weekly. I don't care if you're a guy, a girl, whatever. You're looking at every picture. But Rolling Stone has some good stuff. And every issue, there's one or two things that I love. The Hulk Hogan thing. Not this issue, but the last one was just riveting. I just thought that was so well done. You didn't write that. It was a guy named
Eric. Who did write it? Was it
Eric Hedder or something?
Yeah.
And then this issue, they had a feature about a porn star named Sasha Gray, who might be the first mainstream, you know, the first porn star they always talk about, the first one to actually cross over. This was good stuff. It was excellent, and I felt like... I don't know. It was 10 good minutes. I'll put it that way.
That's good. That's good. We can use it.
It's a good magazine.
Yeah. I think so. You know, compared to some other places I've worked, Rolling Stone is a pretty good organization. You know,
what kind of leeway do you have with them? Do you just tell them I'm writing about this, or do they actually assign stories to you? How does that work?
It's kind of a collegial process. I think we all, you know, one of the reasons I ended up working there is I think I kind of have a lot in common with the editors that I'm working with. So we all just sort of sit around and decide what we're going to talk about. And, you know, but language wise, they don't really interfere in anything. Obviously the magazine's very close to the Democratic Party because, the publisher is sort of a player in the Democratic Party. So it's not an editorial issue at all. It's just something we have to keep in mind. But, they don't interfere at all. I think, I have a lot more freedom than I would say the vast majority of people who work in this business. So.
Yeah, you have two big advantages. The first one, well, actually three, the first that you just mentioned, the second that they'll let you go for 6,000 words if you want, you know, they'll actually give you some word count leeway, whereas a lot of magazines don't. And then I also think, being bi-weekly is a big advantage.
Yeah, you know? bi-weekly is perfect for a lot of reasons. If it's a monthly, you can't do anything that's timely.
Yeah.
Right? You can't cover any news, but you also, you know, you're not doing the daily grind where you're just, you know, out there pumping stuff out into the mass media frenzy every single day. I think, you know, when I'm on the campaign trail, all these guys who work for daily news organizations, they have to do 10, 11 hits a day. You know, the people who work for wire services have to do something every 45 minutes. And there's no way to actually get any material doing that. I mean, you can't get anything interesting. On the other hand, if you're only publishing once every month or two, you can't do anything that's current. So it's like the Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It's just right. So.
One of the other things I like, and... You know, this isn't even one of the top 10 reasons newspapers have gone under, but you know, at some point your advantage is going to be that your writers are better than the other writers. And I think one of the huge mistakes that newspapers made was trying to compete with blogs. And instead of having their writers just work on their one story for that day that is going to be better reported and better written than, you know, almost anything I'm going to find on the internet, they have these guys posting multiple times a day, live blog,
right?
Information from the clubhouse. And it's like, that's a waste of time. You're catering to 5,000 readers when your biggest advantage here is that you have good writers. And I think, you know, in Rolling Stone's case, like you're working on a column, 6,000 words, it's going to suffer if you're also posting 10 times a day or 8 times a day or whatever.
Yeah, that's the newspapers made a huge mistake because the big advantage that they have is that they have some resources, you know, and they should be able to fund some real investigative journalism. They should be able to take some really skilled guys and put them on a story and let them get really, really in depth.
Mm.
I mean, there's no way a blogger is going to break the Watergate story. It's just not going to happen. You can't let a guy you know, work for 3 weeks or a month on something and not come up with, big breaking news stories every day in any other business except the newspapers. But they've gone away from that. They've tried to compete on the speed arena with blogs and with TV instead of doing exactly the opposite. They should have gone the other direction, and that's not what they've done.
We had I had the ombudsman on the BS Report, the old ESPN ombudsman, Leanne Schreiber, like a month ago, and she was predicting that she thought eventually the future would be newspapers, if they survive, aligning with TV stations. Mm-hmm. And the TV stations would give them some of that immediacy and the video and all that stuff, and then maybe the newspapers could go back to actually what they made their bones on, which is reporting and writing and being better than ever on the internet. The thing, I'm convinced, the thing that killed the newspapers, the more I think about it, the more I read, the more people I talk to, obviously the Craigslist and losing all the ads and all that stuff, that was the number one thing. Like, you're just not going to replace that. And, you know, the other main problem is that they're just so slow to react to whatever's happening. Like, you know, not having a fantasy sports column in the Boston Herald until 2005, stuff like that.
Right.
Like, just not seeing where life is going. But the big thing I think that killed them was when they tried to monetize themselves in the late 90s, and everybody was afraid to put their credit card online, and it didn't work. And they were like, oh, well, that can't work. So now what do we do? And they just didn't kind of say, all right, let's be patient. Let's give this 4 or 5 years, whatever. Did you read what Cuban wrote about newspapers in his blog about how it should be work like Amazon almost?
No. What did he say?
It was fascinating. Like, he basically solved the newspaper crisis in four paragraphs or whatever it took. He was saying how it's like easy pay and newspapers should be like Amazon, where anything I order from a newspaper should be easy. I shouldn't have to give my credit card every time. If I want to get a subscription for 6 months, I just click on it. I'm a Boston Globe Prime member. If I want to buy 10 archived articles, I just click on the 10 and I'm done. They've made the technology so complicated that every time you have to get anything from them, it's a pain in the butt. If I want to buy the Boston Red Sox 2007 World Series retrospective, it's a 40-step process. Just let me click on one link and mail it to my house.
Right.
But that's yet another thing that they've missed. But
yeah, Right, they're mostly terrible businessmen, and the things that they've worried about for decades are no longer relevant. So they're completely out of their element right now. They don't know what to do.
Well, where do you see reporting going? You know, because
I mentioned this
in a Kevin Garnett thing a couple weeks ago. Like, my biggest fear is that the writers are just going to drift toward the internet.
Yeah,
and you're going to lose the quality and all that stuff.
That's probably what's going to happen. I think what's one thing that's really interesting is that people are probably reading more than they ever did before because of the internet, and they're probably reading, you know, developing more loyalties to specific writers than they ever did before.
I'd agree with that.
And the problem is that the business hasn't figured out a way to make money out of that. The old model is you worked for a publishing company. And they somehow figured out how to make money through, you know, either newsstand sales or advertising or a combination of both, and then they paid the writer. But I think what's going to happen in the future is that there's going to be some kind of thing where, you know, Bill Simmons is just going to be on the internet, and he's going to have a site, and that's somehow going to pay for itself, and you're going to make whatever you're worth. They're going to find a way to convert views and readers into money directly, and that's probably what's going to happen. There aren't going to be these middlemen anymore, which is, you know, on the one hand it's too bad, and the other hand it's sort of interesting. But I think that's probably what's going to happen, because there's just no it's just the business model doesn't really work anymore for print, and magazines too are really going to have an uphill battle. I think they're going to exist in some form, but they're not going to be as big as they were before. I don't know. What do you think?
I think newspapers are just in trouble because they have that whole other issue of the unions where they can't even figure out a way to cut costs because it's impossible. Whereas magazines, I think it's a lot easier to just say, hey, we're cutting 50 guys today, or hey, we're going this direction.
Right.
What's interesting to me is the lack of imagination with some of the magazines.
Mm-hmm.
I look at Entertainment Weekly, which is a magazine I still read every week and enjoy, but it's maybe 12 minutes, 13 minutes, whatever. But how does that magazine not work? That magazine, for a guys like us who love movies and love sports and love pop cultures, that should be the seminal magazine of our generation.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, I don't know what it is. It's like, well, you know, top 10 lists and what to watch and summer movie previews and, you know, a couple columns, but not really like a wide spectrum. The magazine should have 10 columns. They should have a guy like you writing 6,000 word columns on why X-Men is actually the worst thing that's happened to Hollywood in 10 years or whatever angle. But that's the kind of stuff that I think would work, and I just don't understand what they're doing.
Well, one of the things that happened is that, you know, when USA Today hit the scene, and what's that guy's name? Newhart, is that his name?
Yeah.
Who ran you. And, you know, this theory that people don't actually want to read, that they just want to look at little boxes and little graphs and little pictures, has totally infected the business, and everybody believes it. And so all the direction that the business has gone in has been to make stuff smaller, to cut down on the length of things, and to increase the amount of graphics and the amount of pictures. But every time that, you know, magazines have tried that, it's proved that, the most durable organizations are the ones who took just the opposite path. I mean, you remember what happened in the late 90s and in the early part of this decade when all the lad mags like Maxim tried to blow away, you know, Playboy and, you know, Rolling Stone and Esquire by taking that approach. And what ended up happening is the magazines that focused much more on the writing and the reporting were the ones that survived.
I think that's going to happen again. I really do. And it's the biggest advantage they have over the blogs and the immediacy is the fact that, all right, you get your instant fix from this stuff.
Right.
But if you want the substance and you want the best writers on the planet, come here.
Right.
If you want angles that you haven't seen before, here you go.
Right.
And I think Rolling Stone has done a good job of that where, the 6-7 months that I've been reading, there's two or three things every issue that I'm like, wow, good angle. And the same thing like with your Men's Journal piece that we talked about, Cashman, like, yeah, I like that. That's an angle I haven't seen. That's where they're going to win. But in the meantime, you know, I don't know how many are going to survive. Like, obviously Vanity Fair, I think it seems like they print money, right? Like they're doing pretty well, but partly it's because I know if I buy Vanity Fair, I'm going to get two or three things that are going to take me 10 to 15 minutes to read a piece that I'm going to learn from, I'm going to appreciate the writing, and I'm going to be interested in.
Right, right. But they also have the advantage of having, you know, the best demographic to advertise to, and all the upscale ad companies, advertisers are going to want to go to that magazine. So
deep pockets to get, like, hey, Michael Lewis, here's a big fat check to write about Iceland.
Right, right, exactly.
They kind of use it like Theo Epstein with the minor league draft.
Right, right, exactly.
And for sports magazines, I think that's a little more tricky because the mainstream websites have gotten really good and there's so much discourse and opinion with sports that I think I even found it when they moved my deadline back for the magazine 3 days. I used to be able to hand in things on Sunday. It was in newsstands on Thursday. Now I have to hand it in the previous Thursday. So it's going to run online 5 days after I wrote it, and it's going to run on newsstands 7 days after I wrote it. Man, a lot can happen in 5-7 days,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, kind of a long lag time.
Yeah, and it's, for me, you know, I have to constantly think of abstract ideas now that can last for 3 weeks instead of, for instance, I wrote about the latest issue how access has changed with athletes and how in the old days it worked one way and now it works another way. If our old schedule had been in place, I probably would have written something playing off the Bulls Celtics series or something that happened Saturday or Sunday or the greatest day ever, something that tied into what just happened. So it's, I don't know. It's just, it's interesting. I mean, it's fun for me as a writer in a way because it makes your brain work more. But on the other hand, it makes me wonder, like with magazines, when, you know, bi-weeklies or monthlies or whatever, so much time can pass.
Well, with sports, it seems like the future is going to be on the internet. I mean,
yeah, I think so.
And it's going to be driven by a whole lot of different things. But clearly, you know, guys like you are what's going to, really anchor the big sites. So
I would say, I would say different. I would say that I think these blogs that are attached to teams, where if I'm a Minnesota Timberwolves fan,
right, Okay.
And I have one place that I can go to get all the information I needed about the team, every link. And on top of that, I have a message board to argue about my people with, the guys with. I have video clips I can get. If there's a ticket deal on, you know, the Sacramento Kings are in tonight. They've decided to put the top level for half price. I can find out there. Basically, every experience I have with my team is captured by this blog. And
right.
on top of that, they have two or three writers that I like.
Right.
I think that could be where it goes a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I do. I read PatsFans.com and, you know, Sons of Sam Horn and all that. But I also read ESPN.com every day, basically.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you want to get the basic information that's relevant to your team, but, you know, when you want to waste even more time, you need to find the good writers, and you know, I think that's what's going to drive traffic to those big sites.
Yeah, I think you're going to have a couple big mainstream sites, because
right.
the bottom line is there's only so much time in the day, and there's a big pie. So
right.
how can you get that piece of the pie? Wow. Well, you go totally mainstream, or you go the other way. You're totally niche. You're devoted to a specific team. You're devoted
right.
to just sports gossip. You're
right.
devoted to following every single thing that happens with the sports media.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever niche you hit, you're going to hit whatever person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's also the issue of, there's, you know, when internet publishing, you know, there's sort of a demarcation point where you either make no money or you make tons of money, and you have to have enough traffic to actually make money selling advertising. So there's going to be just a few sites that are commercially viable, and the rest of them are all going to be, you know, sort of scraping along. So I think there's always going to be a couple, two, three, four sites that are going to be there and, you know, functioning, like ESPN and SI.com and Sporting News, and that's probably going to be about it, I would imagine.
Well, the one interesting thing that I've noticed with just me is that people in my age group and your age group, those are now people that are moving into positions of power.
Right.
And, you know, when I was coming up in 2001, 2002, my column was doing well. We had a whole bunch of ad salespeople selling to other ad salespeople who could barely figure out how to use email. They're like, what? The internet? So people can read them? Like, they click, what's a URL? And, you know, the ad sales community in general is just 4 or 5 years behind whatever's happening.
Yeah.
So now I think we've seen it starting to swing the other way, where they're now excited about digital. Oh, this is cool. Oh, so I can put a banner on this column and I know that X amount of people read it. And that's the biggest advantage that the internet has, is that you know exactly, you can tell whatever buyer, 750,000 people read this column. Here's the number.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to decide, is that a better way to spend my money than a 0.7 rating on a TV show, which you really might not have had that many people watching it because they just had the channel on and they fell asleep or whatever.
Yeah, it's much more quantifiable, the results they're getting. And, you know, especially when you are getting a lot of readers, that's going to be impressive to advertisers. So I think they've probably caught on to that. I'm sure.
Well, what's crazy is that with TV, you would think, like, this is a multi-quadrillion-dollar industry.
Right. A quadrillion.
Quadrillion. It's a quadrillion-dollar industry. And they have really the dumbest and most arbitrary and most unreliable system to rate shows that you could ever have. They just basically put boxes in random dudes' houses.
Mm.
They don't account for – they just started recently accounting for – I TiVo'd Lost while I was watching American Idol, and I ended up watching both shows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no way to account for that. No way to account for I flip back and forth between the Bruins Hurricanes game and the Red Sox game.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They don't measure that.
I turned the volume down while I was
They don't measure. I watched Jimmy Fallon's show because I fell asleep while I was watching Jay Leno's show and the TV just happened to be on. I have no idea what happened. I didn't see a single moment, not measured. It's just crazy to me. Like, you know, one of my friends obviously hosts a late night show and he tells me some of the ways they measure this stuff, and it's just insane. Like, you just can't believe it.
Right.
So yeah, I wonder, like, at some point we're going to,
I always wondered whether somebody would be smart enough to consciously manipulate the Nielsen system, because you could get figure out which communities are being targeted, and then, you know, induce them all to watch certain television shows, and then you boost your ratings. And
yeah, there's like some code of Omerta if you have a Nielsen box.
Right, yeah.
It's like witness protection program, yeah.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. Like if you tell anybody what you're doing, that they're going to disappear you to Ecuador or something like that.
I remember when I was doing in E60, I started doing E60. I did a couple segments for them, and some reader emailed me from, like, you know, Omaha. Mm. He's like, hey, I'm not supposed to ever tell anyone this, but I have a Nielsen box. And I guarantee you get a rating from me tonight. Good luck. It was like he was like outing himself. I have a Nielsen box. Don't tell anyone. Are you kidding? That's our TV rating system?
Right. But, right, yeah.
All right, anything you want to plug?
No.
Talked about All Ugly. God darn it.
That's all right. I couldn't find your column, by the way. Is it still online?
Oh, no, it's not online. You wrote last month, you did an All Ugly piece. That, by the way, got forwarded me to a few times. People... Although, I got to be honest, the Yukos comments hurt. I'm not going to lie. Hurt. And for a Red Sox fan to lash out at Yukos'
I'm not lashing out. I was praising him on the contrary.
Look, you have to answer to your own conscience.
Come on, can you explain to me how the sweat is pouring off the brim of his helmet in the first inning, at the first at-bat? Where does it come from?
Well, let's say Yuke happens to get Men's Journal and reads that and goes into a 2-for-23 slump because he's so wounded that you called him ugly. Do you feel bad?
Yeah, that would be
very could
awful.
Have affected his season. Actually, maybe you inspired him because he's hitting like 450.
Right, right. Maybe he's imagining my head every time the ball comes into the plate.
No, I did for my old website, I think in 1998, I had the All Ugly Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm. Who was on it?
Well, here's the thing. The ugliest athlete in the history of sports, hands down, will never be approached again, is a guy named Don Mossy.
Who he was in the column. He played for the A's, right?
Yeah. He's not even the Mount Rushmore of ugly. He's the one-man Mount Rushmore of ugly. He was so ugly that it was actually a much-discussed thing at the time about how ugly this guy was. And there's a famous baseball card with him. And you spell it M-O-S-S-I, I think. But,
right.
So anybody who is not aware of whatever, please Google
Don
Mossy.
You know what he looks just like, actually? You've seen Men in Black?
Oh, yeah.
You know the Tony Shalhoub character who gets head blown up?
Yeah. Yeah. But I have a whole thing in my book about the ugliest players that I don't want to totally step on. But
oh, I see. Okay.
I would just say that Popeye Jones, for me,
oh, he was good.
Things considered, was the Sistine Chapel of ugly. Popeye Jones was like, it was good on TV, but only in person. Yeah, much like you have to see the Sistine Chapel in person. Only in person could you appreciate Popeye Jones.
I saw Popeye Jones in Russia, actually. Remember, he went to go play there?
Yeah, and how was that for you? It was memorable, right? I bet you remember the game.
No, I didn't see him play any game. I saw the street.
I bet you remember the moment.
Yeah, I definitely remember the moment. He stands out in Russia, that's for sure.
How long did you live in Russia?
About 10 years, actually.
What?
Yeah, yeah. I was there from 91 to about 2001, 2002.
Were you exiled?
No. I was just where I was living. I was a reporter over there, and I had my own newspaper in Moscow for years.
Were you inspired by that bad Sean Connery movie or something? What was that movie where he goes to Russia?
The Russia House, right?
Russia House. There's got to be somebody's got to explain how there's somehow never been a good movie about Russia. Everyone has been disappointing, I think, except for Red Dawn.
Yeah, but that wasn't about Russia.
It wasn't about Russia. It involved Russians, yeah.
Yeah.
And Rocky IV, I guess. But actually, a movie set in Russia, I think we've just whiffed across the board.
That's true.
I can't think of one good one other than maybe Reds, which, you know, won Oscars, never watch Reds if it's on.
Yeah, that's a crappy movie.
Yeah.
There's some good Russian movies, but American movies made about Russia, I can't think of a real good one, actually.
Look, the original La Femme Nikita was a good movie. That was made in Russia, I think.
Was it?
Yeah, I think so.
Huh. I didn't know that.
Or maybe
that.
It was. Maybe I'm insane.
Yeah.
Wow, 10 years in Russia. How'd you follow sports?
Huh?
How'd you follow sports?
Well, I didn't for a long time, and then there was the internet when that started happening. But
you basically missed all of Michael Jordan.
Yeah, most of it. Yeah, I missed a lot of things. I missed The Simpsons. I didn't know what grunge was when I came home.
You missed 90210?
What?
You missed that 2-0 and
that,
Saved by the Bell.
I missed that for sure. Yeah.
That's a tragedy.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure. I'm really deficient in that area.
Oh, man, but you got to catch up. It's on a soap channel or whatever. You know what you missed, though, which was a good thing, was you missed, like, just a phenomenally depressing Boston sports drought.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, it was definitely a nice time to leave. Like, you came back in time for SB 36.
Right, right. Yeah, no, in fact, that was just when I was coming home. But we had started the casinos in Russia started to show NFL football every week that year. So that was when I started watching football again, was like year 2000. So that was when we started getting back in touch with that.
Yeah, you missed the Stanley Cup parade for Ray Bourque and the Colorado Avalanche, the all-time low point in Boston sports history. Woohoo, Colorado!
Well, Wade Boggs on a horse was bad, too.
That was bad. But throwing a parade for an opposing player, I think, will never be topped. And
that's
what Jerry Callahan rightfully called Boston loser town. Everyone forgets now. Everyone's mad at Boston now because we've had success. And they're like, oh, you guys, you've had so much. You're so lucky. But it's like, you know, we also hit the depths, so
I missed Roger Clemens' comeback with the Blue Jays, which
his chemically induced comeback. Yes.
Yeah, I'm glad I didn't get to see that. That was good.
Yeah, you missed the Fenway fans cheering him in 1997 after he struck out 16.
Did they really do that?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that happened with Boston sports that now we sweep under the rug. It's like some sort of marriage where you're like, yeah, my wife slept with the busboy at the country club a few times. You just kind of pretend it never happened. There's a lot of stuff that happened with Boston sports from 95 to 2001 that we just now never happened. All right, I'll let you go. When we come back, though, or we'll have you back on to discuss the All Ugly thing, which we really should have delved into. It's my fault. I'm a bad host.
That's all right. All right, well, when you're in New York, give me a call sometime.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on. Matt Taibbi, and we could see you in the Rolling Stone, Men's Journal, and what other, any TV gigs?
Yeah, I'm going to be on Real Time this Friday, actually.
Excellent. That's a legitimate plug.
Yeah, so I'll be on a Friday night.
All right. Thanks for coming on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline.
All right, thanks a lot.
All right, bye-bye.
Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNradio.com.
Peace out.
You laughed, you cried, you turned up the sound repeatedly, and now it's all over. This concludes another installment of the BS Report. And with all the talk about sports, Bill Simmons neglected to mention this important just-breaking news.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin.
The $5 foot-long anthem rolls on with Subway Everyday Value. So many of your Subway favorites are $5 foot-longs, like that Tastetacular Spicy Italian $5 foot-long and the piled ridiculously high BLT $5 foot-long, both made to your order on the freshly baked bread of your choice.